50-50. You got to give me 40 or 30-70. Like, which way are we leaving here?
So I think he loves being a Met, and I think the Mets love having him. I know the rote thing to say about relievers is they're so fungible. You never know what they are one year to another.
Yeah.
Not him. He's great every year. I mean, he's also healthy all the time. He had one freak injury in his year. He jumps up and down, blew out his patella tendon. He's been on the injured list for 15 days besides that in his career.
Wow.
One time. So you're always one year away from when he does blow out or when he is bad. I actually think he, in a way, is tougher to replace than Pete Alonso for the Mets, because right now, you know who's in the Met bullpen? Brooks Raley, A.J. Minter, who probably won't pitch the first month of next year, coming off a lat injury this year, and... No, I'm not forgetting any names.
Craig DuBois, that's it.
I have some early onset stuff, but I didn't forget anything. They need this as an anchor, right?
Yeah.
But he's really good, and he's really good all the time. He's really good in the clubhouse. He's willing to take the ball. This guy was coming up on free agency, was taking the ball multi-innings. That last game of the season, he came in like the third, fourth, fifth day, whatever he came in.
Yeah.
This is a good dude who's a gopher dude who's going to be loved in the market because there's some stability there when they're in an unstable job.
He's not more important than Pete Alonso, though. Just saying.
But I could find some replacement power production.
Alonso's
averaged
40 homers a year the last four
seasons. Yeah,
total, he's 162.
By the way, they probably will end up signing both, right?
It's another edition of the Talking Mets podcast here on this Sunday, November the 16th, 2025. Of course, I'm your host, Mike Silva. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You can get me on X at Talking Mets, no G, and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com, no G, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com. And you can get me on the new and improved website, TalkingMetsPodcast.com. Check out our premium content for less than a cup of coffee a month. The chat, it's free. Updates on the show, interactions with me, it's all there at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. And of course, I want to thank the good folks in the Believe Network for supporting this show. Welcome to another edition of the Talking Mets podcast. I come to you here on this Sunday night, our weekly show. If you haven't had a chance throughout the week, some great content over at Beyond the Mic. You're missing out if you're not part of it. We did our first Trash or Treasure, looking at some of the recent value signings by David Stearns and his front office. Also did an analysis on Carson Benge, looking at some comps for Carson Benge based on analytics that were up there by our good friend over at X, TJ Stats, and also some scouting profiles. So check that out. Big news since David Stearns. And that's really one of the themes of the show is I came to you with a midweek edition, really recapping Stearns' comments at the GM meetings. The GM meetings are like that kickoff of the hot stove. Everybody's starting to get some discussions going, obviously league business as well. But most importantly for the Mets, of course, is both, you know, Scott Boras at the GM meetings, Edwin Diaz there at the GM meetings. Mets have two big free agents. We'll talk about that. We got a little bit of information from Stearns. I think that although a lot of people feel there's so much GM speak these days, we'll get again into his comments, even though I spoke a little bit about it earlier. I think they became more crystallized as the GM meetings went forward. We're going to have a special guest. It's that time of the year. Jim Allen, our friend Jim Allen, who covers Japan baseball. Now, Jim Allen is a retired writer. He covered baseball over in Japan. I had a chance to catch up with him earlier this week. And every year, Jim joins us around this time because of how big Nippon Professional Baseball has become with the imports, especially, you know, this year with three major free agents over the last couple of years. Yamamoto coming over. We've talked about Kodai Senga. And Jim Allen has a great website, jballallen.com, if you want to get information from somebody who has watched a lot of these players from when they were very, very young and has great insight. So we're going to talk to him. Of course, you have a couple of names that may be on the Mets' radar. Murakami, Kaz Okamoto, and Aime, who is the pitcher now that is coming to the forefront, a Boris client. And, you know, we'll talk a little bit more about that. So we have that. We have the mailbag. We have a lot to get to. But before we get to Jim Allen, I wanted to set it up all here. So Stearns has his comments at the GM meetings. And I know that a lot of times things could change. And we don't know truly what's going to be going on here. One of the things about the Mets, they're really, and I say it all the time, there's no leaks. Usually Andy Martino, one of the ones who's most clued in on the front office. Anytime he speaks, he seems to have a good feel of how the organization looks at things. It's been a little bit harder, I know, for him to get the insight that he usually gets. You know, you have Heyman, who has a lot of connections with the Boris organization, so you should listen to him when it comes down to it. Joel Sherman tends to have his ear to the GMs and what's going on out there. And really, with the Mets, you just don't get a feel 100% of where they're going to go. So you're going to have tons of educated speculation throughout the offseason. And we've spent most of the postseason where the Mets weren't part of it, I'd call it the early hot stove for us, speculating about what they need to do, setting out the blueprint, a lot of talk about acquiring an ace, a Paul Skeens, a Tarik Skubal, maybe a Sandy Alcantara. The more that you read about that, that seems less and less likely to be a thing. More likely for the Mets to go after a higher-end, top-of-the-rotation-type innings guy. Maybe there's some talk about them acquiring, and we've talked about it here, a young pitcher who might have some upside to be able to put themselves in the conversation. It looks like the Mets, and I think this is the biggest learning from the GM meetings, will allow their young players like Beatty, Vientos, Alvarez, and maybe even Acuna to get a chance. I mean, Stearns spoke very highly of Acuna and talked about what I thought was interesting, and maybe he's trying to jack up his trade value on the market, but how impactful Acuna could be, even without a bat that is league average with his base running, his defense. We saw that with his elite defense, how he saved a ball game late in the year in Cincinnati when Edwin Diaz was about to give one away against the Reds. So these core young players, they're not part of the core yet, but the hope is that they could become part of the core. Now, I know that there's been some ideas of floating, trading Brandon Nimmo. I think that's complicated. And I also think with $20 million or so a year, I know it's, for another 5 years? I don't think that that's an unreasonable contract. Nimmo has a no-trade clause. I know Nimmo's not the same elite run creator that he was earlier in his career. He's become more of a, you know, maybe mid to lower of the order hitter. I know the Mets have put him in RBI positions, batting him in the cleanup spot or third or things like that. But, you know, to me, Nimmo is still very useful. I think floating and seeing what you could get for him in a trade, and maybe they have an idea about how they want to reallocate some of that money. I think that's a smart move to at least do that, but I don't think that that really is a realistic situation. For me, here's what I really gleaned from the last week. I feel a lot better about Alonso and Diaz coming back. It's clear, listening to Carlos Beltran, listening to the writers as they came back from Las Vegas, the Mets have prioritized both Diaz and Alonso. Diaz with the qualifying offer, I think it's going to be really hard for him to get an offer of the kind of significance that it would take. And I think in both cases, the Mets will have their value for them. I think it's a generous value. And I think the only way these two guys get away is if another team comes and just goes into the stupid level of money. Now, with Diaz, that's hard to do with a qualifying offer. I know for a while there, earlier in the week, Ken Rosenthal reported about the Blue Jays. It seems Rozel Iglesias might be more on their radar. You know, clearly the Blue Jays are smarting from losing the World Series in the most horrific fashion, blowing a save. I mean, literally inches, maybe a fingertip away from winning a championship. So that's really where, you know, maybe cleaning up the ninth inning. Hoffman proved not to be a ninth inning type guy after a great year out of the bullpen with the Phillies. Obviously, they should have watched the series with the Mets and the Phillies, as Hoffman had his own troubles in the postseason with Philadelphia. So I think it would be very hard to see anybody blow Diaz away. I think that I know his comments about 50-50 coming back. You know, players have to do that. You can't take away your leverage. The fact that he even talked about it that way is a positive sign. Alonso, it sounds like the dialogue between Boris and Cohen and Stearns and the Mets camp was much more productive than it was a year ago. I think the Mets, and I know Boris is touting it, about how Pete has done a lot of work on his swing and his approach and had probably the best year of his career. And arguably, of course, depending on how you look at the metrics and the numbers and what have you. And going forward, I think that, you know, the real debate here, and I think everybody gets caught up on defense, and I've said it 1,000 times, I'm not as worried about defense at first base as I am up the middle. I think Pete's run production, his RBI production, his prodigious home runs, his yearning for the spotlight, his lack of backing away from any big spot, the protection he provides Soto. Soto was very open about that. You don't sign Soto for a long-term deal and then rip him away or rip away a big part of his protection in the lineup. Top five right-handed hitter in baseball. You might only have a couple of right-handed hitters, and Aaron Judge is one of them that's been better than Pete in the since he came up and burst onto the scene in 2019. So I think both of them are going to be back, short of someone doing something crazy. Now, could the Red Sox, like I said, go and offer him a 7-year deal, you know, maybe $210 million or something, and maybe the Mets have to pause at that point, because it does sound like after that 2030, that 5-year window, you know, Pete will be around 36, 37. The Mets want to have some pause there later in the contract. I think both of the players, and that might be part of the structure of the deal, and maybe that will come into play if there are other offers on the table, will include some deferred money. Not a bad thing to have some annuities in later in life when, you know, you're not a baseball player anymore. You know, obviously it's interest-free and what have you, but it's nice to get those big checks when you're 55, 60, 65 years old. You never know what life brings you. So, you know, I think that right now, in a lot of ways, the Mets are very much going to, I feel, stay Standish Pats-ish on the positional player side. Where I think I'm reading that they may potentially play a little bit with the roster is at second base. I know it came out that Jeff McNeil had thoracic outlet surgery. That's not a simple surgery. It has ramifications. Maybe his days in the outfield are over. It sounds like, listening to Stearns, his days in center field are over. Certainly his days in the corners, you know, maybe even right field, might be limited. Second base, you know, as far as the arm and the throws, he could probably do that. That's not a big deal. And when you look at second base, and of course you have Acuna, and maybe you have Jet Williams, and the fact that Stearns was so bullish on putting Carson Benj's name into the center field conversation makes you wonder at, you know, how long, if he shows or continues to show good on base and, you know, power skills, will Jet Williams' name get put into the second base conversation? Makes you wonder if they're comfortable going a little bit more defensive at second base with Acuna and maybe worming a Jet Williams in there. But if they want to make an upgrade and they want to trade McNeil, and maybe they trade McNeil to shed salary, maybe for prospects, maybe they could get some kind of starting pitcher for him. There was some things floating around the internet, all totally unconfirmed, that Chris Bubik from Kansas City was a name that maybe you know, the Mets could be involved with when it came to McNeil. So we'll see how that plays out. But, you know, ultimately, there's not a heck of a lot of second basemen that would be available that, you know, would be better than McNeil. Think about it. If you go up and down, you have your, you know, your top second baseman in the league, Nico Hoerner, Terang. Maybe you want to put Jazz Chisholm in there. Gleyber Torres, who's a free agent, but, you know, has a qualifying offer attached to him, Marcus Semien. But when you talk about second basemen that are out there, you know, maybe McNeil is one of the best options. Maybe Brendan Donovan, a versatile guy, a guy who's played the outfield as well and could play a little bit around the diamond. Maybe the Cardinals make him available. I think the big name that could be available is Ketel Marte. In a lot of ways, Marte fits the Mets a little bit more with the kind of offensive profile that he has. You know, he hits the ball harder, more of a power hitter. You know, it's a little bit, he's in his later prime, but everything that they like about hard hit and bat speed and launch and power, Marte fits that more than Donovan, who's more of a soft contact guy. You know, what would it take to acquire Donovan? Would it take a Jet Williams and a young pitcher? You know, the Diamondbacks are not a rebuilding team. Would it take a piece from the big league roster? The thing about Marte that's even additionally interesting, he's got a reasonable contract. He signed a contract, and he's making about you know, after this year, he makes 15 and makes $27 million over the next 2 years. $15 million this year, $12 million next year. So it's kind of like a wash with the McNeil money. And then he elevates a little bit after that in his late, you know, mid to late 30s with $20 million, $22 million a year. And then there's a player option at the age of 37. So he's signed deep into his late 30s. I guess that might be a bit of a negative. Would Arizona eat some money to get a better package? That would be interesting. But, you know, to me, those two names are the two names that are out there. You know, everybody wants to throw Jeff McNeil off the island here. But look up and down. Just go to Fangraphs and look at the second baseman. Look at the names out there. Be realistic about who's available on the market. There's not a lot out there. Via trade, you know, Jake Cronenworth, you know, maybe that, with San Diego potentially being for sale. You know, maybe they could get involved there. I think the name Fernando Tatis Jr., if there is a fire sale, i.e. Miami Marlins style in San Diego because of the sale, maybe that's a name that gets involved. So I think with the Mets, if they're going to get any kind of change out of their team, it's going to be on the pitching side. You keep hearing Framber Valdez's name. You bring back Diaz. You dot the bullpen with some good value signings around him. You look and you get maybe a Framber Valdez, a guy who could bring you innings in the rotation. You'll go around and you see what kind of young arm you could import into the rotation to possibly add to the Tong and the Sprouts of the world. Nolan McClain, don't forget Christian Scott is in the mix now. He's a bit of a forgotten man. I'm sure as we get closer to the spring and we hear about his rehab and how he's coming back from Tommy John surgery, we'll get more information about him. You still have Senga. You still have Manaea. You know, Clay Holmes showed some chops down the stretch there in Miami. So, look, there is a quantity of pitchers. I think they need innings in the rotation. I think that's how they're going to go about free agency. I think that this may not be the sexy plan or the rip-the-team-apart plan that a lot of you guys wanted. But, you know, I think that when you start to look at the team and you look at how they have eight really good prospects right now that could help on the big league level in 2026, how the farm system is well-regarded. You don't want to just go out and rip apart from that farm system capriciously. And I don't think Stearns is going to do that. And Stearns has said, even back going to one of his initial conversations with the media at that first GM meetings in 2023, he talked about how young players have to be part of the mix. If you bring back Alonso and Diaz on the kind of you know, terms that you think they're going to acquire, that's another $50 million. You almost have a $300 million payroll at that point. Any kind of good starter who gives you innings is going to be about $25 million a year plus. You know, you have room for a couple of moves when it comes to big dollar free agents. Then after that, you're going to have to start making some trades. So I think we have a bit of an idea of the direction the Mets are going to go. Stearns gave you some nuggets there. It's a bit of a treasure hunt these days when it comes to leaks from the Mets front office. None of it happens. I think the Mets are going to rely a lot on coaching. They have a lot of faith, I think, in the coaches they brought in. They probably spent a good deal of money to bring in what they feel are some of the best coaches in the league. I always feel like that's a dangerous thing that's a little overrated because it's about the player, but in the modern game, they're looking at things a little bit differently. So, and then it comes to the last piece here, what we talk about, and it's the Far East. Now, Nippon Professional Baseball, the Mets have contributed, you know, haven't had the most success there. They've jumped in. They tried to get Yamamoto. They didn't really try for Ohtani. Of course, they got Senga. That was a bit of a surprise back when Billy Epler was still the GM a few years ago, and I know he's a bit of a polarizing conversation these days, even with yours truly. So, you know, to me, that's still an option. Now, whether or not Imai, who, you know, is kind of this unknown, Murakami, who is a guy that has prodigious power, profiles a lot in my eyes, like Joey Gallo, has some gnarly metrics against velocity. And then this interesting Kaz Okamoto, who could play both corner positions, has a little bit more plate discipline, line drive contact, maybe more gap power or decent power, but not the kind of power you'd get from a Murakami or a Schwarber or a Pete Alonso. There's three names out there that are really interesting. And Jim Allen, who is a longtime baseball guy out in Japan, former baseball writer for the Daily Yomiuri and Kyoto News, you know, has his own website. And every year around this time, he comes on and he kind of gives us his perspective on the players. And I think what I like about Jim is that he covered these players going way, way back to when they just broke in. So you get to see kind of how they developed, the kind of people they are. And what Jim is really good at is comparing and contrasting the two types of games, the type of coaching that you get when you're over in Japan versus the United States, the quality of play. So there's a lot of stuff that you could learn from Jim, more than just the numbers that we're going to get or some media-driven scouting report. So let's sit back. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, Jim Allen, J-Ball Allen, long-time writer over in Japan. He's joining us from Japan. He's joining us from the Far East. And he's going to be talking about that and more right after this.
How about Tetsuya Ima as we go back to John Heyman's Twitter? Cebu Lions say they're going to post star pitcher Tetsuya Ima. The righty who throws up to 99 miles an hour should be one of the top three free agent pitchers along with Dylan Cease and Framber Valdez. You guys just hit on both those guys. And specifically, do you think Ima, David, it's hard with Japanese pitchers, but you saw it firsthand with Yamamoto, what kind of impact he can make. What do you see with regards to Ima?
Man, I spoke to a major league scout that saw Ima pitch there in Japan, and he said his fastball has a lot of life. He's got a great slider that he can control. He mixes pitches really well. And speaking to some sources with my Japanese friends out there, they told me that the Yankees, Phillies, Blue Jays, Mets, and Phillies are the leading candidates to sign Ima, along with the Padres, who we know is in desperate need of starting pitching, and they obviously have the advantage of geography being on the West Coast. So those are the teams that are going to pursue him heavily.
Yeah, I think the other interesting thing, just beyond the fact that he throws 99 miles an hour, he doesn't give up home runs. He has a ton of different pitches that he can use. I believe he had a sub-2 ERA last year, super durable. But the fact that he can throw 99 with a wipeout slider and he's got a changeup and he keeps the ball in the yard, that's something that's going to be very, very appealing to a lot of different teams.
You know, timing matters. We talked about Framber earlier. A year ago, before some of these incidents, I think he's not at the GM meetings and he's assured of a certain amount of money. I think the fact that the Dodgers won the World Series with three prominent Japanese players has people very excited about the Japanese market as if they weren't already, but I think it just intensifies the idea of opening up that market, making sure everyone doesn't end up a Dodger at some point. And I think in my, you talk six pitches, in your graphic, you showed his walk rate has gone down. It was a problem early in his career. He seems to have, when you talk to scouts, they say that fastball control is exceptional. The one bugaboo that has come up with multiple scouts is he's a very emotional pitcher. If you watch him, they say it's clear. It's visible when he is having some issues on the mound. They wonder about that here, what that will mean, and if he could harness it. But it was really the only downside I heard about him as I asked around at the meeting.
We're back, and joining me, you guys know him. He's been coming on the last few years, the explosion of Japanese players in the big leagues. Who knows him better? Former baseball writer for the Daily Yomiuri, and I think I'm going to say this right, Jim, the Kyoto News, Jim Allen. Close, he has J-Ball Allen.com, and Jim, welcome. I know it's always 24-hour difference. It's always a pleasure. Early here in the United States, in New York. How you doing out there in Japan? And welcome back. Another year around the sun for you and I.
Yeah, indeed. counting down, it seems like, for me. But yeah, evening in Tokyo and another year gone by and just explosion of Japanese talent seems like a trickle. Seems like a fire hose now.
Well, I know it's, and this is a Mets-centric show, but being that he won another MVP, his fourth MVP, and when Ohtani came over to the Dodgers, we knew he was good. I think a National League fan, especially in New York, we didn't watch him as much, at least I didn't, when he was out in Anaheim. Now they play the Mets in the postseason. The Dodgers are this rolling band. And, I was talking to some baseball fans the other day, and they were like, I don't think we're ever going to see anybody like this. Like, wasn't around for Babe Ruth. Obviously, you weren't. I think that, and I've always said, because of the lack of integration at that point, I'm a little suspect of anybody pre-Jackie Robinson. Because, and even, take that aside,
how the game has become global in the last 20 years. It's so much more competitive. So this to me is more impressive. Putting aside the off the field, the gambling, some of the things that annoy people, I don't think he'll last as a pitcher, but offensively, you can't deny what you're seeing. And if he gives you even some action out of the bullpen or in the rotation, this is the best player of all time. I'm not one to say something like this. The best player of all time is out of Japan. Could I mean, be. What are your thoughts?
Could be. Well, he certainly, I think the key thing here is A, he's super talented. B, he came when he was 23, which to me was really huge because it's a huge challenge for Japanese hitters to come and face MLB velocity. You get a little of it in Japan. You get a smattering of it here and there. But on a daily basis, facing that and adjusting to it, it's quite, of course, you have to be able to. But if you're able to, doing it at when you're 23 is different from Hideki Matsui doing it when he's 28.
Sure. Yeah, so. It's funny you say that because I think that that's going to be a part of the conversation today. You have some hitters coming over.
Sure.
And they have some great numbers. Murakami is one that is going to come up. And you just brought up a great point, whether it be the pitchers adjusting to the ball, the six-man rotation that typically isn't normal for the big leagues here. Right. Maybe it will be. Very talented players, and they perform very well on the world stage in the World Baseball Classic or back in the day in the Olympics. But it's not this shoe-in that what you see in Japan in the NPB is just all of a sudden going to translate to similar numbers.
No.
Talk about that a little bit, because I don't know if the fans really understand. And we're not trying to downgrade Japanese baseball, but it's right. Not everywhere in the league. Not everywhere is it, I guess, big league level. Would you say that?
Well, Japan's major leagues are not as deep, and the style is different, and the training is different, and the rhythm is different. So there's so many the culture surrounding it is different. I had an interesting chat, one I'd been waiting for years, in March with Kosuke Fukudome, who was outstanding in Japan, and then he went to, and then he fell like nobody fell. He fell like nobody fell. He went to America. Yep. Now, usually when I see that, I expect those guys to be seriously mediocre when they come back. But he just, it was almost like he never left. This guy was a superstar. And I asked him what went wrong, and he said, I was very Japanese. I basically didn't assert myself. I didn't do the things I wanted to do. I kept trying to keep my head down and be a Japanese person in an American world. Now, I'm sure there were other issues than that, but that's what he spilled to me, and I get that. The culture is different, and sometimes the cultural difference is difficult. So there are many. Spring training's difficult. Kazuo Matsui, of course, you know, famously got off to other than the game one home run an opening day, it took him a long time to settle in. He was really good. He was really good with the Rockies and his brief time with the Astros, but where he should have been. But he aggravated an injury in spring training, his first spring training with the Mets, that he hadn't had since high school. Because he wouldn't admit it, but he basically came out and said, like, I had a friend who overtrained. It wasn't me.
Yeah. I know somebody that did this, right?
Exactly. I'm talking for a friend. And he's kind of like that. So he spring training ruined his first spring training really threw him. And that has happened too. Just the rhythm is different, and the start of preseason is different. So there's all these adjustments you have to make. And then you have to, the big adjustment, of course, is dealing with the travel. If you're a superhuman sleeper like Shohei Ohtani, That's a thing. You can, if that's your focus, if you're smart enough to have that as your focus, that's great. But a lot of guys don't have that. They don't prepare. They prepare for the wrong things, or they don't prepare for everything, where they underestimate how difficult it's going to be, as human beings will. So I see that with MLB players and veteran players coming to Japan. They underestimate how difficult the little things, the little adjustments will be. And that's hard, as so many. Even Masahiro Tanaka told me, he said, like, I had Ichiro and Hiroki Kuroda as teammates, and they told me, it's like, watch out for this, watch out for that. And spring training still hit him like a hammer.
Yeah, it's funny you bring that up, because I think here in the States, when the fans see a potential Japanese star posted, they don't look at them like any other player. It's almost like this mythical video game. Well, this guy's going to come over and be great. And maybe Ohtani's done some of that, but an Ichiro certainly broke through in a way that before
Sure.
Ichiro, it was like, okay. What are you going to get here? Who could this guy? I mean, I remember, and I think I've said this on the show before, a writer was trying to say to Bobby Valentine when Ichiro came over, I mean, could this guy be like Kenny Lofton? And he's like, oh, he's way better than Kenny Lofton. And I laughed. I laughed, like, come on, Kenny Lofton, who's kind of a borderline Hall of Famer.
Sure.
And, I think that we forget that. And here in New York, we have Kodai Senga, who has been a little maddening. He had a very good rookie year. He's been injured largely the last couple of years, freakish type of injuries.
Yeah.
And I think, and maybe to your point, you brought this up. Here's a guy that is, through an interpreter, is communicating with the American fan. And I think that between the weird injuries, the calf, the hamstring, jumping for a throw, the inconsistencies at a time when the Mets really needed him down the stretch, throwing strikes. And then I think late in the season, he was throwing off the mound in Miami, and maybe this is the writer's fault. They would say, well, he didn't feel like he had his best stuff because it was very hot. And here we are saying, okay, if you can't throw and it's warm in Miami, and it's a dome, by the way, maybe it was open. What's going on here? So there's been some questions about Senga, and he's going to be with the Mets for a couple of years because he can't opt out now. Maybe they trade him. From afar, I don't know how closely you've been following him. Senga was a little polarizing when he came over because at least for me, he replaced the popular Chris Bassitt, who was very good. I think sometimes they try to put him on another level, like especially now that Yamamoto's in the league. I don't think that was ever who he was. So there's a bit of pressure on him, and I think there's some questions about his durability, his toughness. And you really don't know him per se because you're getting these snippets through an interpreter in a post game. And
Correct.
as you're talking, I'm thinking about Senga in the same lens as what you're bringing up with Fukudome and maybe some of the challenges these guys have.
Yeah, I can't speak. I haven't talked to him in since before he left, so I don't really know. I do know his agent. In fact, that's probably a conversation I kind of like to have with his agent, because he's a good guy, and Senga's a good guy, but he has had a history of nagging injuries in Japan, but it's sort of like he's injured all the time, but he keeps throwing 150. Even when he was injured, he's throwing 150, 160 innings a season. So that was the weird thing. He was always hurt, but he was always, he'd come when he was healthy, he was good, and he still found a way to stay in the rotation. He's almost like a mirror image of Roki Sasaki, and that Roki Sasaki was injured rarely but frequently unavailable because of just of his physical limitations as an individual, his personal physical limitations, having to do with his weird bone structure. He was a very low bone density as a teenager, and probably still growing into his body. So, yeah, you know, my basic feeling is you never know what's going on. Don't try to read too much into anything. Senga is a tough competitor, and he'll give you the best he's got. So I don't know, you can ask for more. You can't, But yeah, the injuries are a part of who he is. You know, they're part and parcel of the player. You can't say, well, if he didn't get injured, he would have been Willie Mays or something, because Willie Mays didn't get injured like that.
Yeah, and maybe part of it was his first year in New York. He threw 166 innings.
Sure, it
He
was
started
dynamite.
29 games. He was dominant down in the second half. The freak injury. So the freak injury was the calf when he came back against the Braves
Right.
after a great
Yeah, and
five innings.
he was godlike, and then he gets hurt.
Right. And we know going in, the Mets had some questions about the health, and he had the shoulder issues
Sure.
back in the early part of 24. So, and I think you have a good point. I think that, and the Mets are finally coming around to this, and David Stearns talked about it. We can't rely on him for 30 starts. That doesn't mean they don't like him. That doesn't
Oh,
mean
sure.
he's not part of it. I think that the big question is, okay, if he can only give you 18 to 20, maybe 22 starts, good starts, and then maybe some postseason work,
Right.
does that, can you fit him in a regular five-man rotation? Because to me, the problem with, and Yamamoto, I don't believe is going through this. I didn't study how the Dodgers used them, and after the postseason, I mean, how he pitched, like old school complete games. I admire that. Can he live in a world where he, whatever he gives the Mets, can he do it in a five-man rotation? Because I think the six-man rotation throws off at least veteran players. Now, maybe the Mets do it because they have some kids that might need to have their innings limited. But I think that's where it gets tricky because, okay, you want to keep him healthy. You're having the whole rotation built around him. He's not there all the time, especially when you need him. And when he was there, he's not very good. That's where I think it could get hard for him. You bring up Fukudomi, you bring up Matsui went through a lot here because the
Sure.
fans got angry. He displaced Jose Reyes. He was coming in at a time when the Yankees had another Matsui, not the one the Mets fans got. And New York could swallow these guys up. Now, I don't see that yet with Senga, and I don't get a sense that he's running from it. But
No.
this thing could get really hard here for regular American players. And
Sure.
for Japanese players, it could, look at the, back in the day with the Yankees, with George and what have you, the original OG, fat was the fat toad comment. So
Yeah,
that's what
Hideki
you, Irabu, yeah, who turned out to have a lot of other issues that were
Urabe. He had a
sad
year
at the
where,
end.
well, and he had a year where he was the Yankees' best pitcher. So it's not like he couldn't pitch, but he was a
Yeah.
complicated individual. Individuals are complicated.
Sure.
So no, I think you have to decide. You have to decide whether your formula is will work around him or he'll work around us.
Yeah.
And you have to either, you set him on a pro, you've got to find some solution that works, which is involves communicating with the player, even if it means, calling his agent and getting in and getting involved in that and making sure everybody's on the same page. Some teams are good at that, some managers and teams are good at it, some aren't. I think that was, that's really the thing. And of course, some of the Japanese players occasionally, and this is a hard thing for them, will say, yeah, whatever you want, Skip.
Yeah.
Even if they know it's not right for them because that's the way they are. And I don't know if that's Senga's issue or not. That might be his issue. Who knows?
Yeah, you make a great point there. As we get into the posting season here, a lot of interesting names coming up, and the Dodgers are
Sure.
ruining it for these guys because you've got Yamamoto throwing complete games of the postseason. You have the all-time maybe best player in the history of the game, modern day Babe Ruth and Ohtani. You actually, Roki Sasaki, you called it last year. You were the first one, and I think the only one that said, hey, the guy's good, but this isn't going to be like Yamamoto. And sure enough, he went through a rough season, and now he's coming out of the bullpen, and we'll see where it's going. So if you're listening, for the fans listening, Jim knows what he's talking about. I remember when he talked about Sasaki, they were like, and I had fans contact me, go, oh, what is he talking about? He's making it sound like the guy's not any good. Well, you said he needed seasoning. So knowing that, here we have some interesting names, and the Mets may be in on maybe. The name that comes up most is, and again, I'm going to tell Jim, I apologize if I botch any of these names. I try my best. I should have done a little. So
Pretend they're Spanish.
Spanish, right? Munetaka Murakami is the first name that comes
Is
up.
your Spanish that bad?
Very bad. And I took 5 years of Spanish in high school.
Munetaka.
Munetaka Murakami.
No, there's no Y in there. Munetaka.
No. Munetaka, right.
Murakami.
Murakami. So there you go. Oh. So the, Murakami, right?
Murakami, Murakami, right?
It could be the New York. See, now I'm going to get all sorts of emails from people saying, see, you say everybody's name, you say Cole's name of the Yankees wrong, you keep saying the names wrong. So anyway, third baseman, first baseman, big lefty bat, three true outcome guy, walks, strikeouts, home runs, prodigious home runs, bad defense. Yeah. Some people say, could it be Kyle Schwarber? Is he Joey Gallo? What are your thoughts?
The bad defense, I think, is, geez, people see it and I don't. Maybe I'm blind, and that's possible too. His defense can be good. It can be erratic. It's not that he's not capable. I mean, the second of his two MVP seasons, he was really good. So I don't see that, but yeah, no, three true outcomes guy is probably the best definition for him. My take on him is that he's a perfection. He's like, he's been for the past, since he played, well, first of all, one thing, after he hit his 55th home run, now it's not the record in Japan, but the 55 home runs stood as the record in Japan from 1964 to 2013. That's like imagining Roger Maris broke Babe Ruth's record in 1972 instead of 1961.
Right.
Right. So it was legendary. And so when he matched Sadaharu Oh's 55, it was a big thing. The next home run was going to be huge, even though the record was already 60. But that was a new record. The ancient record was still 55 etched in everybody's mind, like when Barry Bonds hit his 714th home run. It was a huge deal. Right. Well, it was that kind of deal for him. And he basically didn't hit another home run for a week and a half or 10 days or 2 weeks or whatever. And after that, he was pretty much toast for the next 2 years. He was hitting home runs, but really doing very little else. The home run salvaged his value, but it was not great. It was not pretty. He stopped hitting for average for two. In fact, he stopped hitting for average, period. He was bad. He was pretty bad in the WBC, except for two big clutch hits. One that won the semifinal against Mexico, and one that tied the game against the United States. I think he did the game-tying home run after Yu Darvish gave up Kyle Schwarber. No, it wasn't Kyle Schwarber's. I guess it was. My memory is poor.
That's okay.
So anyway, he was, and I talked to him after that, and he said, you know, I tried to make too many adjustments, but I've got a plan. And he said, you know, I'm never focused on what went wrong in the past. I'm 100% on what's going to work for me next. So the scouts like him. I won't say they love him. They loved him 3 years ago. They like him now because of what he did as a 23-year-old. Hold on, 1920. 2019, he was 19. So when he was 20, he was 22. So he was 22. They liked him, what he did. His approach is the right approach. When he hits the ball, it goes a long way. He had a big three home run game this past year in which all three of the home runs were hit out to dead center. One of them hit the batter, the shortest one hit the batter's eye.
Wow.
One hit
That's
the scoreboard.
Serious power. That's
one went out. One went out of the hit the scoreboard, which is higher, and one of them went out of the park to dead center, which is huge. Even though it's Jingu Stadium, it's still huge. So he's got that approach. His approach is really hit it far. So I think that's an approach that teams appreciate. Now it's a question of can he manage it? Can he hit the top level velocity?
There's some gnarly statistics, and back to what you said earlier in this conversation about Velo, and I don't know if this is true. Someone said that he's against elite velocity, he's hitting about 100. Now, I don't know if that's true
I
because I
don't
don't know
know
what
if
kind of advanced
that was
analytics.
this year, perhaps. I don't know. Yeah, Yaku Cosmopolitan is really the guy. Yuri's the guy who's really in on that, as well as a few others. I don't. There are a number of people doing very good work now, so I don't want to downgrade them. But no, they followed it, and I don't know how valid it is. I remember people telling me the same thing about Seiya Suzuki. And saying, oh, he doesn't have a good record against high velocity. Well, here's the thing.
Solid hitter. Solid hitter.
Nobody, pretty much everybody does poorly against
Yeah.
big velocity. I mean, Roki Sasaki, he doesn't have a good fastball, but the damn thing is fast. So you until you can time it, it's not easy. He didn't, you know, it's not a great fastball because it's straight and it runs onto the barrel of left-handed hitters, but it's still fast. And when he can throw it and he can locate it with any reasonable ability, it's really deadly combined with the forkball. So Murakami's in sort of that same boat. He's got the right approach, he knows what he's doing. It's all a question of can he time the heat? Now, he may, if he. I don't, I wonder, I really wonder what the adjustments he was playing with the last in 2023 and 2024. He said, you know, I was trying to basically learn from Ohtani and the guys when I was in the WBC, and I was going to adopt those things. And I think he went way too far. But that's just me. But my thinking is he's trying to find this perfect, he's out to find this perfect form for him. And now, the thing is, now if he finds it, working with American coaches who have a slightly different approach than Japanese coaches, it used to be radically different, now it's slightly different. Japanese coaches historically would look at a player and say, well, your body type is this, so your swing's going to be this. And an American coach will say, what are, you know, well, basically, tell me what you're trying. If you want to talk, tell me what you're trying to do, and I'll tell you what I see. And it's a building process rather than a you should be doing this instead of that process. It's a feedback. And working with American coaches who are trying to achieve the same goal as the player, which is not often the case in Japan, could be what he needs. I don't know. I mean, they're usually when you see a player who does really, really well and then does poorly in Japan, the first thing they do is question their mental toughness. We saw that with Sasaki. Actually, we saw that. The funny thing is, we saw that a lot with Sasaki after he said he wanted to play in MLB. Before that, he was the guy who was being manipulated by outside forces, and that's what was that was the tragedy of Roki Sasaki. And then after he said he wanted to play in MLB and it became an issue, then it was he was the problem. Murakami, they said the same thing, and they, you know, they blamed, oh, he's got a girlfriend or whatever, you know, so who
It's
knows?
always gossip. See, the Japanese media is just like the American media. They love gossip and they
Oh
love
yeah.
narratives. And it's a
And most of them
per
are they're just nonsense. I mean,
yeah, and that drives me crazy because I think back in the day before social media, it was always bad, but it kind of faded away. Now with social media, I think it's even worse.
yeah.
And look, this Murakami is polarizing because people love power. In an era where he's been in video games and fans play video games, they look at this and they say,
Sure.
okay, this could be the next great power hitter in MLB. But realistically, could he, you know, with all some of the development you're talking about, he's not going to come in and dominate. I mean, he'll hit home runs. He probably will struggle. We don't know about the defense. I
Well,
think
he's
the
still young,
market he
though.
goes in, and he's still young. He's only, what, 25 years old?
25.
So he's young. Yeah. And we have to remember that because if he was coming out of AAA or AA, a little old for AA, but AAA, or he was an American sure. prospect, I think we would be more patient. Look at Mets fans with Brett Beatty and Francisco Alvarez. But because he's a pro, because he's Japanese, because of the WBC, because of video and hype, he's not going to get that opportunity. And I think that's wow. – and I'm as guilty of that as anybody. But we have wow. to remember that, yeah.
How much things have changed over the decades.
Mm.
I remember Reggie Jackson saying about Hideki Arabu, well, he didn't face Barry Bonds and he didn't face Mark McGuire in Japan.
So, right. Well, that I do remember that. You're right.
Mark
and,
McGuire. Yeah.
Yeah, and, I do remember that comment. And there was a lot of jealousy. And I think maybe it's Ichiro. But also, let's face it, fans want to win. Teams sure. want to win.
Oh, sure.
And we don't care who the 26 active players are. They're nope. from South America, the nope. U.S., Japan. Who knows? I mean, Korea now, which is – I mean, American players are going over there and coming back. So, you know, to me, that's where it's part of it. Do you think that knowing some of what we just talked about Murakami, what is the comp? Is Kyle Schwarber a fair comp? Is Joey Gallo a fair comp? Are we shortchanging him on the defense? There's definitely a lead.
Well, I'm not the best person to ask. I'm you know, I look at
but
the
you think he's a big
numbers.
Leaguer, though. You think he's a big
I think
leaguer.
He can, well, I mean, he's a guy who has a – he's the big question mark because he has a huge ceiling because of his age,
yep.
and because of his approach, because of what he's shown already at his age. He's an extremely selective hitter, which – although technically does not bode well, but I mean, he has hit for high average. He's not a guy who necessarily has what they used to call old players skills, because he has hit for a high average before. He's a good base runner. He's, you know, people say, people look at, I think much of the defense thing is he'll make a horrible play. He'll occasionally lose his concentration in the field, and I've seen that where he makes just a horrendous play. But that's rare, I think. I think people look at his body type and say, well, he can't play defense.
Can he play first, or is he more of a corner?
No,
a third?
I thought he was okay at third pretty much, actually. Now, Japanese runners are fast, too. Now, the other thing is, of course, the other thing is the Japanese, especially the Central League, almost all the games are played on artificial turf. So that's a difficult.
That's going to make it, yeah, that's going to be. And is that the new artificial turf that we see?
Yeah,
like grass?
It's
not
fake
like
grass.
The old school that you saw
no,
in
it's
Busch
not
Stadium.
Carpet. No, it's
not
fake
carpet.
Grass.
Yeah.
It's fake artificial grass.
Which makes a difference. Back when the carpet, I think a lot of modern fans don't realize. Could you imagine today's players on the Busch Stadium or Royal Stadium carpet, Montreal, the old school? That would be crazy.
Yeah.
You know, Jim, the player that intrigues me from scouting reports that I actually like the best offensively is Kaz Okamoto. Did I say that one? Did I get that one correct? Okamoto?
Close enough that I know who you're talking about.
Right. There you go. Make a laugh. So not maybe the power that we've been talking about, but
no,
still very good power.
He doesn't have Murakami's power. He doesn't have the ups. He doesn't have the super high ceiling.
Right.
Because of his age.
But plate discipline, 20, 25 home runs, versatile. A gold
right.
glove? Is he a gold glove
no,
type?
No. He's versatile. He can play the outfield. He can play third. He can play first. He's a smart player. He has a variety of different styles. He has a lot in his... So Murakami is more the guy who's trying to refine one style, to find the perfect style that works for him and just go with that. And Okamoto has adjusted very well to the dead ball with the help of his manager here in Japan. And he's adjusted to it very well, and he's basically become a high average hitter. So he's got he's a he's a he's he hits for average, and he's got pop here. He can play various positions. You wouldn't put him at second, but he could play third. He wouldn't kill you. Corner outfield. I don't know about his arm. It's probably left field is even, yeah, MLB, the probably corner outfield doesn't look really good for him, but he can do it. He can do it in a pinch, which adds to that. He's been fairly healthy. This last year was probably the most exception, the most difficulty he's had. But he's, yeah, he's at the very towards the end of his prime. So you're getting what you get now, and then you take the adjustments. Now there are guys who have gone at his age, who've done well. Norichi Aoki did okay,
Yep.
but those are the he's the athletic guy. Okamoto's not that athletic, so Masataka Yoshida is probably the closest comp for him. He's a right-handed Masataka Yoshida, who can play third base.
Right.
So it's, yeah, he might. I think the various styles will make his adjustment easier. So I see a lower downside for him, and a lower ceiling as well.
Interesting. Now let's get to maybe the most interesting one. And I think there's going to be a lot of pressure on him because of Yamamoto, I believe, and because whoever signs him is probably going to be expecting an ace. And I think I got this one right. Imai, right? Did I get that one right?
You
Imai?
got his family name right. You want to try for the first name?
Satsuya, is that correct?
No.
No.
Tatsuya Imai.
Tatsuya Imai. So
You're getting there.
I'm getting there. I'm gonna get beat up on that. Elite ground ball rate. He had a good strikeout rate in Japan. Had
Yeah,
some workload. What are your thoughts? Because he's gonna be
he's
competing
good.
with some other arms out there that are on the market.
He doesn't have the location I mean, Yamamoto's his stuff often plays a bit better. Well, I mean, he doesn't have that master curveball like Yamamoto has. His fastball's better. His splitter's better, but he doesn't have the location. And the other thing he doesn't have is it's almost like in Japan, he felt like sometimes the competition wasn't good enough for him. It wasn't interesting. He looked like he wasn't challenged sometimes. Like, as one scout said to me, he'll come out and he'll throw the same pitch. I watched him pitch and he threw, I don't know what, he just threw split, decided to throw splitters one inning.
Yeah.
He tried to see if he could get the side out by just throwing splitters. And he does weird stuff like that. So I don't know what to expect from him, but he's shown remarkable development the last few years. And interestingly enough, the guy who took him under his wing, he is also being posted, Kona Takahashi. Although he was dynamite 2 years ago. He was the best pitcher in Japan too. Well, other than Yamamoto, he was the best pitcher in Japan 2 years ago. And he just completely fell off the wagon, so to speak. And I don't know. He's an interesting guy. I think he'll make some good adjustments too. But Imai's got the real stuff. Takahashi is not the big swing and miss guy. He gets results, but he's not a big swing and miss guy. I think Imai's got the stuff to where he can succeed. He has been very healthy. He and Takahashi had who Takahashi learned sort of was under the wing of Yusei Kikuchi when they played for Cebu. And when Kikuchi went weight training and fitness mad in his final 3 years, Takahashi was there and built himself up from this skinny little kid to this really, he's really jacked now. And Kikuchi was training with him. Kichiguchi, excuse me, Imai was training with him and following his lead. So these guys were really, they're really into what they need to accomplish. Takahashi, he had some tough times, but Imai is, I think he's ready for whatever he's going to get. I don't see him being, of course, Yamamoto. That would be a surprise transition for him, but I see him being something like Kodai Senga.
Another name, I know he's not over there, but you're familiar with him, and he's available now, and he was under the radar because of the winter of Yamamoto a couple of years ago, and that's Shota Imanaga. And
Sure.
he had a rough second half,
Well,
lefty.
he was hurt most of the season.
And the Cubs didn't pick up his option. But here's a guy, and he's intriguing because the whip is really low. He quietly gets people out. I know he's not overpowering. I was thinking a little of him when you were talking right now, because sometimes because of Yamamoto, because of the dominance, because of what you're looking at in terms of upside, in this era of pitching, if these guys could put teams to sleep, get ground balls, get outs. I mean, Imanaga finished top five in the Cy Young a year ago, in 2024. People are forgetting about that. He's available. Any thoughts on him? I know he's in his early 30s. I know that there is a finite amount of time, maybe in his prime. I think people have sa fans at least have soured on him, or the media has soured on him. The Cubs maybe more procedurally didn't pick up the option because of, maybe keeping their options open on the market and what have you. What are your thoughts about Imanaga? Injuries obviously impacted him. Still had some good numbers last year. Whip under
No, I
one,
mean
that's
he
serious.
knows he knows what he's doing. He's a good guy to have on the team. I like the adjustments he makes. Now he's paranoid about his velocity. He has been for a few years, and but he the thing was his game was never really about velocity. It was just now my question is, I haven't seen his like Statcast numbers from this year. Did he lose the hop? If he lost the hop on his fastball, then he's really in trouble, because his big thing was less velocity and more spin. He has incredible active spin he gets, the effective spin he gets on the baseball is incredible.
He's down about a mile per hour. So from his rookie year in the big leagues, he
Well,
was at
that wouldn't
90.
trouble me. That
That
wouldn't
it's not
trouble me.
crazy. I think for a guy, I think the issue for this particular player is the home runs. Now he's playing at Wrigley Field. That could contribute to it, of course.
A little bit.
I
A
mean,
little
30 home
bit,
runs
but.
is a lot of home runs to give up.
Oh,
But I maybe
sure. Sure.
not crazy in the era of commoditized home runs. Not crazy. Mainly throws half the time is fastball. He's got a split. He's got, at this time, the sweeper slider. I don't know how they figured that out, Jim. It drives me crazy because I look at all these metrics and there's sliders and sweepers, and to me, it's a slider, right? That's all it is. So he's got a decent mix. He's lefty. I'm sure he'll land on the market.
Oh,
It'll
yeah.
be interesting at in
It
a lot
will
of
be.
ways.
I like him. I think it's again, he's the sort of a thing you just have to take what you get with him. And this is the case with most Japanese players. You take what you get, and if you can't work them into, if you can't find and make them work, then don't expect, I know MLB is very much a, this is the way we do it, and if you don't like it, tough it. But there's always players who benefit from a different approach. There's always players who have a flaw. And if you focus on the flaws, I mean, who is the Lenny Dykstra? I mean, he would, there was a great line from Bill James is, the people would have you think that his defense is so bad that he was banned from McDonald's for all the French fries he spilled. But if you've got a guy who's got a 400 on base percentage, you can find a place for it. If you focus on what they can do and find a way for the to take advantage of them of that good. And if you can't, if you say he needs to, if you try to limit the number of slots, or if you narrow your focus to the way baseball should be, then you're going to miss out on a lot of talent, whether it's a Japanese guy or a Korean guy or a guy from California who's just neurodivergent, you know, or he's got a certain issue, physical issue. People need, you know, if people need to be treated as individuals, not as MLB. This is the way we do it.
Yeah,
I mean that's the old school, and that's the reason why 20 years ago we had these absolute studs coming to Japan as hitters and dominating Japanese baseball, because they got 50 at, you know, they got 50 at bats in MLB, and they said, well, he was the best AAA hitter in America, but in 50 at bats in for the San Diego Padres, he didn't produce, so let's ship him to Japan.
Hey, so, listen, you can make a lot of money and you can have a good life, and that may work out for the American. It's a tough transition for the American player too.
A lot of those guys, they didn't know what they were getting rid of.
Yep.
So the point is,
Tuffy Rhodes, right? Tuffy Rhodes.
Tuffy Rhodes, best import player to ever come to Japan. And so, no, these guys were available because teams weren't flexible. They weren't, you know, we're an old school organization. We know what we're doing when they do.
Right. Yep.
So I think the team that looks at it and figures, well, let's try that. If this doesn't work, we can try that. It helps with the younger team. I remember when Shohei Ohtani came in 2018, I was in spring training talking to the coaches. The Angels were a very young team. On a team with, for example, with a lot of veteran pitchers, there might have been some flack about a pitcher being the DH. You know, how come he thinks he's so special? But the Angels were a very young team in the pitching staff. And they said, you know, we're pretty open to new ideas, but there are teams where that won't fly, where you're expected to be old school. Every team's different. So if the teams, I think that's the thing. If you got a Japanese player who has a lot of question marks, or any player who's got a lot of question marks, you need to ask yourself, are we ready for that? Not can he be the guy we expect to fit a predetermined spot on our roster.
Hey, Jim, a couple of things before we wrap up. I was thinking about Senga, and this came from some of the fans who throw in some mailbag. Okay. What about Senga? You know, I didn't bring it up before. What about throwing him in as the closer? You know, the Mets might have Edwin Diaz next year, but they're going to need bullpen help. I always worry about guys who have durability issues having to get hot, up, down, maybe 3 out of 5 days. But I thought of, and maybe this is a lazy comp, but Koji Uehara back in the day.
Uehara, right.
Yeah, with the Red Sox. He was a starter briefly with Baltimore. Made a great transition to the bullpen. I know he was a late prime. Thoughts on maybe Senga in the bullpen?
Yeah.
Any
no,
idea?
I think he would do well there. I mean, it's almost
the ghost fork is going to be nasty coming out of the pen there late in the game.
Oh no, I think he'd be dynamite. You know, if his physical issues, you know, it's all a question of what he can manage. If that physically works for him, I think he'd be dynamite. He was excellent. I mean, he worked his way into being a starter from the bullpen. So no, I think he'd be dynamite. And now it's only a question is that going to, in Uehara's case, it was exactly what he needed, because his knees couldn't stand the wear and tear of 5 innings on the mound.
Sure. Sure. Absolutely. But, absolutely. That's interesting. That was something that came up. So are there any names that we're missing? I mean, do you have any insight to maybe, I know there's a couple American players that may be coming over, our old friend here, Anthony Kay from the Long Island area.
Anthony Kay, dynamite.
You like Anthony Kay, because he was a top prospect and he fizzled a little bit, you know, here, local guy, went to school a stone's throw from where I'm doing this interview.
Right.
Is there other Japanese players that we're not talking about, but or American players? Anybody you want to names you want to throw out to the fans as we wrap up that
Well,
maybe will.
I saw that his teammate Andre Jackson is also going to be a free agent, and he's pretty good too. But Anthony Kay, yeah, remarkable control. The thing is, Japanese baseball is different, which is a good thing, is a really good thing if you're a pitcher, because you go over there and there are things you have to do, just like there are things you have to do in MLB, there are things you have to do in NPB. You have to be able to hold runners, you have to be able to throw strikes, you have to be able to do a few things. I mean, they do a lot, and you've got to play defense. They do PFP not every day, but almost every day. And so the guys who go over there, now that's just the basis. And then they've got the challenge of they've got a whole bucket of players who are few and far between in MLB who will, if you let them, they'll throw you, they'll have 40 pitch at bats. So you have to learn to put people away who are not really trying to do anything except make you work. So you make adjustments, you add to your toolkit. And these guys come over here. Another thing the guys come to do get in Japan is they get accustomed to throwing to challenging hitters in the zone in pressure situations, in big crowds. They get confidence in their stuff. I mean, they
That
know what's
doesn't
going
bother me though. I think that we get away from that a lot here in the States, where with because of spin, there's nibble, 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 the walk rates explode. Sometimes I think mano a mano, for lack of a better word, hitting
Yeah,
is
getting ahead
hard.
of hitters,
Hitting
getting
hard,
ahead.
get ahead, throw a fastball. More than likely, there's a 75% chance you're going to be successful even in that scenario.
Well,
I know that's myopic.
you miss with the first pitch. The guy, the batter, unless he's expecting that first pitch, he's off balance. If he makes contact, okay, the results are good. But if he doesn't make contact, then he's really up a creek. So, and then and then you expand the zone. But here's the thing, in Japan, a lot of these guys come over there after being up and down AAA in the majors, where they had to adjust to radically different circumstances, and they had to perform ASAP. Here they come in, they've got guaranteed contracts, they've got guys who aren't all trying to drive the ball, so they get accustomed to challenging hitters in the zone. But there are guys who are trying to drive the ball all the time. Not a lot of them, but they are there. So it's not like, oh, Japanese hitters don't do this and Japanese hitters don't do that. But they get accustomed to working. It's like, it's almost like, I hate to use the expression 4A because it's, in my mind, it's basically nonsense. But they do get to operate at a level where it's like an extended trial in MLB, where they have a chance, they know that they can get away with mistakes until they get comfortable and confident throwing challenging hitters in the zone and knowing that their stuff will play in the zone. This is stuff a lot of minor league pitchers don't get unless they're like super talented before they throw the ball. So these guys come over here who have the talent, but they failed to make the adjustment in the limited time they got in MLB. They come over to Japan, they pick up a new pitch, they hold runners better, they play better defense, they're smarter players, and adjusting to Japanese baseball is not easy. I mean, it requires some intelligence.
Culturally, similar to the other way, culturally too, at
A
that point.
hundred percent, 100%. So these guys come over and they've often, think of Ryan Vogelsong, who he got run out of town here. I mean, he was moderately successful, but he just added so much to his game that it just flipped a switch and he's an all-star.
Yeah. Jim, I was one last thing. Market, does that matter as we look at players coming over? Playing in New York is tough. Playing for the Mets is tough. I know that everyone talks about the Yankees. The Mets are a tough situation. You know, a lot of expectations, Yankees across town. Is it better for them having experience with the Yomiuri team? Is their markets in
I
Japan
think it is.
smaller? Does
I
that
think it
help at
is.
all? Yeah.
I think it does. I think it. If you've played for the Giants or you've played for the Hanshin Tigers, I think it's sort of like you go to America and it's like pressure. What pressure?
Right. Yeah, I've been using that because I don't think the fans here realize how much passion the Japanese fan has overall, but in those markets in particular,
Yeah,
because
you
of
play for the
the
Giants, you stub your toe, it's a national
it's
emergency.
a national emergency, right, at that point. Hey, are you familiar that a friend of Japanese baseball, Bobby Valentine, was elected into the Mets Hall of Fame? Did you know
Oh
that?
my gosh. Did they
They
put the glasses in there?
They've already talked about that. Yeah, they've already
Okay.
talked about that. So I thought that'd be a way to wrap up. So what do you have coming up? Obviously the fans could go to jballallen.com. If they're in Japan, you know, maybe give them a guided tour of the place, talk a little baseball. What do you got coming up? I know you're not as active on X
Well,
at jballallen.
I'm getting into the I'm probably redoing I'm relaunching my site soon. I expect to be there were issues around that. I've technically forbidden from operating my own business for the last 5 months, so
Got it.
long story there. But no, I'll be back, and I'm coming back. I don't know how if I'm going to be doing it on a daily basis like I used to when I had to watch games to write the English language baseball copy 5 nights a week. But I will be continually doing commentary, especially cultural and historic commentary
Sure.
and other things. So yeah, no, if you come to Japan, look me up. Hit me up on social media and I'll be happy to take you to a ball game.
All right, Jim, be well over there.
Thank
We'll
you.
talk. We're going to be very curious how this winter plays out. And you know
It'll
what?
be
This is our
fun.
daily, this is our daily thing. Another year around the sun, and I'm sure we'll talk
Yeah.
again soon, my friend. All
Well, I
righty.
got the WBC coming up in March,
Yes.
and that's Japan's thing, so that's going
And
to be fun.
they have been very successful, so it'll be interesting. So we'll catch up
All
around
right.
then.
Well,
Be
thanks for
well.
having me.
Thanks a lot. That's Jim Allen. Jim Allen is our guy for Japanese baseball. Some interesting things. At the very least, you guys got to hear me do a phonetics lesson on Japanese players. So, anyway, let's take a quick break. When we come back, mailbag, wrap up. And in the meantime, while you're waiting, go to at jballallen and jballallen.com. Check him out. Start following Jim Allen. And we might need more interaction as the Far East starts to make its way more and more into MLB and our American game. We'll be back with more right after this. Right, we're back. Final thoughts. I want to thank our good friend Jim Allen. And look, I look at what he's talked about here, and really, when you look at the players, I don't really think on the offensive side there's a lot of fits for the Mets right now. But Imai is somebody interesting. Now, I think because of the success of Yamamoto, anybody who comes over is kind of going to get, that, okay, is he the next one? Or everybody's going to assume he's going to be the next big stud. But, to me, he's largely a two-pitch pitcher. I'm not saying he's Senga. He's a lot younger than Senga. He's a mid-rotation guy. If he could get his stuff together, maybe he's a little bit better. Some of the comps as I was surfing around is they had like Joe Musgrove, Kenta Maeda at his peak, maybe a little bit more of a light version of Masahiro Tanaka. Those aren't bad comps. I think for the Mets, and I don't know what the budget 100% is and what it will cost. I mean, clearly it'll cost a little bit more to get Imai because of the posting fee and everything like that. But that cannot be your import this offseason. You have to have at least one of the innings guys that we've talked about, the Dylan Cease, the Framber Valdezes.
you know, maybe a Zach Gallen. I know Lucas Giolito's out there. You know, I just think you got to do one of those guys. I think you got to get one of those guys in order to really turn this rotation around. And, you know, who knows? Maybe if you need to shed some payroll, maybe you traded David Peterson. You never know what you can do with the rest of it. You know, I'm not thinking Senga is going to be traded, but, you know, ultimately, you know, there are some things you could do. So I don't mind Imai. I really don't. And, you know, and by the way, I botched. I looked at it during the break. It's Chris Bubich. I said Bubik. If it's Bubich, maybe I said it right. I can't remember. I really got beat up there on the pronunciation. So I got to work on that. I got to work on pronouncing these players' names. Once they get in the fold and I get a groove with these players, it's easy. Although Ottavino, I screwed up a lot. Ottavino. Cole over in the Yankees, I kind of botched that one a lot. So yeah, there you go. So you know, one of those things. So so let's get to the mailbag. Let's wrap up here and get to the mailbag. Let's see what we got. So I'm gonna bring up the best of the best between the chat, X, and of course the direct emails. Love to always hear from you. Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. Don't put the G, no G, remember that. So let's get to it. We're going to kick it off with a longtime listener, John, who wrote in earlier in the week. Thanks for listening, John. And John says that I like out-of-the-box thoughts, and I do. And I don't think his thought is that out-of-the-box, although maybe it is. But John brought up, and we talked a little bit about this in the Jim Allen segment, Kodai Senga as a closer and how the ghost fork would really play up in the ninth. And I think John is assuming Senga's the closer as an option if Diaz walks, which I still think is not going to happen. I think Diaz is going to be back. But I think Senga coming in out of the bullpen is not a crazy idea. You heard what Jim Allen had said, that he did it earlier in his career. Now, Senga, and I'm bringing up his baseball reference page, Senga has not come out of the bullpen. And, well, let me see. You see, they don't really have games started on a consistent basis. But it looks like the last time he came out of the bullpen was probably a while ago. It was probably about 10 years ago. I mean, he did it earlier in his career. So he did it when he was a very young player playing for SoftBank earlier in his career. And that's all he played for was SoftBank when he was in Japan. But I look at, and there have been, look, starters have been converted to relievers. You guys all know the story about Dennis Eckersley and John Smoltz converted to a reliever. Even Curt Schilling for a hot minute came out of the bullpen. A lot of that was when he was coming off an injury and what have you. A lot of people don't realize that Curt Schilling, earlier in his career, actually, Curt Schilling came out of the bullpen. And then later in his career, I think it was with the Red Sox, Curt Schilling came out of the bullpen. And, you know, we've seen Clay Holmes go from starter to reliever. Yeah, in 2005, Curt Schilling came out of the bullpen. He didn't do a great job out of the bullpen. He was also starter that year, but he came out of the bullpen that year. That was, you know, after the bloody sock, and I think he had some injury issues. But there's a comp for Senga that I was thinking about, and I brought it up during the segment, which is Koji Ohyuhara. Now, you might not remember him, but about 2009, he came over. He signed with the Orioles. He was not a great starter, about a league average starter, but he converted him into the bullpen and then became a setup guy in Baltimore and eventually went to the Red Sox and became their closer. And he was dominant. I mean, he finished seventh in the Cy Young in the year that the Red Sox won the World Series. He had a 1.09 ERA, was great in the postseason. If I go and bring up his postseason numbers in 2013, yeah, I mean, he did not give up a run in the World Series. He saved a couple of games, saved three games in the ALCS, did not give up a run. Really was, you know, he was the ALCS MVP, rightfully so, in that series. But Ohyuhara was a guy that, for his career, had a 162 ERA plus, whip under one, struck out almost 11 per nine, less than two walks per nine. Now, I don't know if Senga could have that kind of command and control and that kind of low walk rate. And I don't know, with the shoulder injuries and with the maintenance and all the other stuff, if he could go up and down a lot, or how much out of a five-day span, out of five games, could he pitch three times, or is it two out of five games? So I don't think he could be your primary closer. But if he's only going to give you 20 to 22 starts, and let's assume that, you know, if you look at the Mets rotation right now, And let's just do a quick take. Let's assume the Mets sign, and I'm just going to speculate, a Framber Valdez. So they get a Framber Valdez in that rotation. They have Nolan McClain. They have Clay Holmes. They have David Peterson. They have Sean Manaea. They have Christian Scott. Am I missing anybody here? And then Kodai Senga. And then, of course, you know, let's see what other arms come up from the minor leagues. Would you take Senga, say, look, I have the depth. He's not a guy that could go once every 5 days. He needs to be stretched. Would shorter spurts, if he conditions for it, 2 out of 5 days, 3 out of 6 days, 3 out of 7 days, you know, 3 times a week, come in, be a backup closer, set up for Diaz, you know, maybe be the seventh inning guy. Is he a guy that goes multiple innings? Maybe you bring him out of the pen for multiple innings. Stearns talked about a need for somebody like that. Jose Buto was that guy when he was here. I know they tried to make Oscar Brazenbaum that guy for a little bit. You know, I know maybe Max Kranick will be back. You know, Brandon Waddell. There are names on this whole thing that possibly could be that guy. But it will be interesting to see if that is something that, there's no indication the Mets are going to go that route, but I wonder if Senga would be good in that. And yes, I think he could potentially be dominant in that role for one inning with that ghost fork. Would it change his repertoire? I don't know. I mean, it would be very, very interesting to watch. I guess it's something to watch as we get closer to spring training and we see how the Mets rotation develops. Maybe we'll dive a little bit deeper into that. But Ohyohara was a great comp, and he went from a very average, a little bit above league average. He was later in his career. He came over to the States when he was in his mid-30s. So, hey, you know, John, that is not a crazy idea. And, we'll see. Our buddy Sam says, why does the media obsess and get excited over Scott Boras saying boring puns? It's so overplayed by now. Over it. I got to tell you, it drives me crazy. Look, I guess Boras does it. It's kind of his shtick, and it creates attention for him and his clients. And I guess for the media who stands around in a hotel either during the winter meetings or during the GM meetings, just standing around waiting for news, it's exciting to them. In a lot of ways, I feel like Boras is mocking the whole reporting process. It's almost like he's throwing, he's the king and he's throwing pieces of meat out to his constituents. Oh, here you go, peasant. Here's a piece of meat. I hate it. I don't think it's my thing. It was almost like when I'm trying to think. It was another player that used to kind of like, well, Derek Jeter used to really piss on the media, and they would eat up everything he would say. He'd be just nasty, and they just eat up everything he would say. Oh, it's Derek Jeter. So I don't like the Boras situation, how it is. I don't even pay attention to it. I don't laugh at it. I think the media has played that one out. And that's the thing about the media. They tend to get things that are cute at the beginning, and then they beat him to death because that's kind of their thing. So, Sam, I agree with you. I don't pay attention to it, nor should you. And it has absolutely no play into where the players go. I guess it's like Boras, instead of saying, hey, Pete's got a great market, he could do some kind of polar bear pun or whatever it may be. But I don't find it interesting. Maybe you guys do. Maybe you disagree. You can let me know. That's why you contact me at MikeSilva@TalkingMetsPodcast.com. Now, the last thing here as we wrap up, there was some debate on X. Anger from Mets fans saying how the Mets always let all-time popular Mets go. And I kind of argued and said, it's not really the case. They very rarely do. When it happens, there's circumstances. Now, I know everybody's going to bring up Seaver. And Seaver is like the ultimate, not reading the tea leaves, allowing an all-time great to go. I mean, Seaver's an all-time great. Now, a lot of other Mets throughout history who are very good, I don't know if they are at the level of Seaver. Like, Seaver is the pinnacle of greatness. I mean, that's a top five pitcher in the history of the game. You know, Piazza, great catcher, great offensive player. When he left after 05, his career was coming to an end. He only played a couple of more years after that. And I think at that time, it was probably right for both sides to move on. Strawberry certainly was in his prime. Strawberry had a ton of issues. I personally spoke to Frank Cashin when he was inducted into the Mets Hall of Fame in 2010. And Frank told me that it was his agent that pushed him to L.A., wanted him to be in L.A., wanted him to be in movies. There was a lot of personal gripe between both sides. Like, the Mets were pissed about the Strawberry drama. I think Strawberry didn't feel respected because the Mets were negotiating. You know, they had just fired Davey Johnson. And, you know, I think Strawberry was all, and Strawberry admitted this to me on my show, and he said it all, since then. And I interviewed him in 2007. He was just starting to rehabilitate himself. He said it was a mistake. He shouldn't have done it. Shouldn't have done it. And he'd be the first to admit it. So I don't know if I would consider that one of those things. Hernandez and Carter were done by the time they left. You know, I don't know where else you would really want to say. DeGrom re-signed here in 2019. When he left, I don't think he wanted to be here anymore. Some fans brought up Daniel Murphy, Jose Reyes. Reyes, maybe, but I also think Reyes had a lot of injuries leading up to 2011. I don't know how the Mets felt he would hold up. He really didn't. It was only a couple of more years. I think Reyes wanted to leave. I mean, I think if Reyes wanted to stay, and there's always been debate about whether the Mets were offering him the contract or not, it's kind of like he got what he wanted, and I don't know how it exactly went down, but if I remember correctly, he didn't really even give the Mets a chance to really match or do anything. Some people bring up Zach Wheeler. Look, Zach Wheeler, I was wrong on, but Zach Wheeler was very spotty in 2019. He had a good final 2 months post-All-Star break, but he was wildly inconsistent, and he had a lot of red flags with injury that did not turn out to be as a big deal as I thought when the Phillies signed him, but now with the TOS, you're seeing it come to play. I don't think you're ever going to see Zach Wheeler be the same again. If he comes back and is any version of Zach Wheeler that we've seen before, I'd be shocked. And, you know, I guess we'll see. I hope so. I don't want to see anything bad for him. I don't think he's going to play more than a couple of years. I'd heard you after this contract is up. I think he's got another year or two left. He's going to retire. So there's that. Murphy, big postseason in October. But before then, questions about him. Had a serious knee issue, which turned out he only had a couple of years left in him. Could have definitely used him on a three-year deal. It was a deal that the Mets should have matched or given. They didn't. They wanted to go more defense up the middle. I'm not sure I'd call that an all-time Met. Mets never let David Wright go. You could argue, hindsight, maybe because the team was in rebuild, they should have traded Wright and Reyes. That's a whole different conversation. Maybe not for this. So, you know, letting Seaver go the second time, you want to bring that up? Man, he was a different pitcher at that point. They kind of got caught up in procedural moves when it came to, you know, losing players that were unprotected. I don't think they thought anybody was going to draft him at his age, and it turned out he could have helped him in 84 and probably 85. So maybe Seaver, but other than Seaver, and that's twice, where can you really say the Mets let all-time popular players go? Now, would Pete go down as one? I mean, look at the Yankees. They let Cano go. I mean, Cano here, he was at Citi Field this past weekend, you know, for the, you know, what was he playing for, Puerto Rico? And I mean, they let him walk to Seattle. I mean, Aaron Judge, I'll tell you what, Aaron Judge was close to walking from the Yankees. So, you know, he was playing for the Dominican. I'm sorry. What was it? Dominican Puerto Rican game? Puerto Rico? Yeah, it was Dominican Republic versus Puerto Rico or something like that. So, yeah, I you know, I don't really think that that's a fair statement. I don't think that's a fair statement. And I think that the fans believing that they always lose their best players, I just don't think that that's true. I don't think that that's true. So, you know, to me, it'll be interesting. I don't see Diaz walking. I think Pete's more of a flight risk. I think the Mets will find a way to bring them both back. I think the only way you see either of these guys leave is if they want to leave. They don't want to be here. And I don't think that's the case, or somebody completely blows them out of the water. And I think that's more likely for Pete than for Diaz. I think the qualifying offer saves the Mets in the Diaz situation. And look, I think Diaz didn't really test free agency the last time. He wants to see what his value is. He wants to feel loved. He wants to get a feel. It's always interesting to see what other teams think of you and be recruited. That doesn't mean you don't want to be where you are. You know, it means that you want to experience something that he's never experienced. So, and Pete didn't really experience it last year. It was a pretty cold winter. So he wants to be courted a little bit. So let go out. You know, Brandon Nimmo went out and got courted a little bit a couple of years back before he re-signed with the Mets. with the way that Cohen is, the Mets are not a Will Pond-run franchise where they have to lock these guys in before they hit free agency because they're afraid of a bidding war. There is a threshold with these players. Don't get me wrong. Cohen's not just going to give them a blank check and do something stupid, but he doesn't fear them going out and feeling out offers because he knows in the end if he wants them, he'll have them. So anyway, I guess that's it. Keep sending the emails, the chats on the chat room, on X, on, you know, Mike Silvat, TalkingMetsPodcast.com. We're going to try to every week, you know, unless something comes up, is, you know, we're going to try to get some mailbags and some commentary from you, the fans, and hear from you. All right, that's it. Of course, you could check me out all the time at the TalkingMetsPodcast.com. You get me on X at TalkingMets, no G, and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. Nuji, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. You can get me on Instagram, TalkingMetsNoG. And I'd love for you to come to the TalkingMetsPodcast.com, the new and improved website. You can get the chat, like I said, free, just a free subscription to join the chat. You can get for less than a cup of coffee a month, the price of one of those expensive cups at Starbucks. You can get great premium content. More this week, we're going to look at Jet Williams a little bit. Maybe we'll examine this Kodai Senga closing situation more. Who knows? Maybe there's a flurry of trash or treasure value moves. You never know what we have at the premium content over at Beyond the Mic. And of course, I want to thank the good folks from the Believe Network for supporting this show. I'm your host, Mike Silva. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday. We'll be back with another Talking Mets podcast next week. Till then, take care, everybody.